You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Saving Dolma. It's a very powerful film that looks at the plight of migrant domestic workers through the story of Dolma Sherpa, a domestic worker from Nepal who is sentenced to death in Kuwait for the killing of another Filipino worker. It provides quite a glimpse at the situation of domestic workers in the Gulf countries, in the Arab region. And it exposes the vulnerability and the conditions of that these workers endure. The film was produced and directed by Kesong Seteng, a filmmaker based in Kathmandu, who has worked on a number of projects and documentaries about the lives of Nepali workers in the Gulf. The film screening, as I mentioned before, will be followed by a conversation with Luna Ranjit, who is the co-founder and executive director of Adhikar, a New York-based organization working with Nepali communities to promote human rights and social justice. That conversation will be moderated by Jonathan Holland, who is the program coordinator for OSF's Nepal and Bhutan initiatives. But before we run the film, I thought I would just provide a very quick bit of context for the film. Migrant domestic workers. It's an issue that was once quite invisible for a very long time. But thanks to the work of many advocates throughout the world, it's been gaining tremendous visibility and attention in recent years. The International Labour Organization estimates that there are between 50 and 100 million domestic workers throughout the world. And that constitutes, in some places, up to 10% of the labor force. Yet, almost 40% of labor laws around the world specifically exclude domestic workers. This has to do with many factors, and you'll see and understand some of them in this film, including the legacy of slavery that has excluded domestic workers and other low-wage workers like farmers or farm workers from labor protections. Domestic workers, as I think you all know and you certainly will see today, live and work in isolation, where they experience extremely long working hours, no days off, non-payment of wages for months and sometimes even years. There's documented cases of that. And certainly their movement is restricted with things such as withholding of their passports and other restrictions on their movement. That's just to name a few of the pervasive practices that lead to certainly an increase in the incidence of physical abuse, sexual abuse, trafficking, and even forced labor. Again, as you'll see in the film, this is an issue of extreme urgency that demands great attention. And that's why the Open Society Foundations has chosen this topic as one of the areas of work that we focus on through the International Migration Initiative and our partners on the ground. But, you know, as a result of what now amounts to a global movement, domestic workers and advocates have succeeded in creating an international instrument to protect domestic workers like Dolma. As many of you may know, the International Labour Organization recently adopted a landmark convention. This happened this past June, which establishes labor standards for domestic workers, We have a handout that I think you all received. If not, make sure you do have that. That has some questions and answers that answer some basic issues about this Domestic Workers Convention. And we recently also had a discussion about it here at OSF. You can find the recording of that discussion specifically on the convention on OSF's website. But for now, let me just turn it over to the film, and afterwards we'll begin the conversation. Thank you very much.
We have a little time for some discussion and questions following the movie. My name is Jonathan Holland. I work at the Nepal and Bhutan Initiative here at the Open Society Foundations, and we support all sorts of different initiatives in Nepal. And we're just starting to be engaged in the migration work, thanks to our colleagues in the International Migration Initiative, who have chosen Nepal as one of their focus countries. So I'm no expert on migration, nor am I an expert really on Nepal, but I've been asked to introduce an expert of sorts, Luna Ranjit, who runs Adhikar, which is this really terrific Nepali community organization based in Queens. She co-founded that organization, and they're really doing terrific work. I highly recommend you check out their website. It's adhikar.org. If you want to know how it's spelled, I can do that afterwards. But and Luna has done, well, I also just say that prior to Adhikar, Luna worked at Andalan Apicha, and New Voices National Fellowship Program. She received her master's degree in public and international affairs from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton and earned a bachelor's degree from Grinnell College in Iowa. Luna was quite instrumental in the passage, or helped in the passage of the New York State Domestic Workers a Bill of Rights, is it? Mm-hmm. That passed a little over a year ago now, is it? Or last year?
November.
She's the expert. And since then has become involved in a movement to really globalize that movement. And there's a push right now to create an international convention on domestic workers' rights. I will ask Luna to maybe share some comments about the film, and then as the moderator, I can ask the first question. And that would really be, as somebody who doesn't know much about the movement to create this new international convention, what impact might it have had on Dolma's life potentially, or of the lives of people in Dolma's situation? Are there any within that effort? Is there anything in that might have had an impact on this situation potentially? Sort of a loaded big question.
I would also say that experts of sorts is the right way anyway, because in terms of my focus has been mostly here in New York and New York State Bill of Rights campaign and taking it to national and international level this year. So I would say that I also don't have a lot of experience working with migrant issues in Nepal. But I think in terms of your question of like how it might have affected, I guess, as Maria said earlier, the International Domestic Workers Convention was passed at the International Labor Organization Conference on June 16th of this year, but it's still too early it's not been ratified anywhere, so it has not gone into effect yet. And even when it does go into effect, it will only become law in the countries that ratify it. So given that there is very little possibility of any of the Middle Eastern countries ratifying it anytime soon, I mean, I don't think there is going to be a direct impact. And not just the Middle Eastern countries, we're not expecting United States to ratify it anytime soon either, and United Kingdom actually voted abstained from it, did not vote for it. So there are many countries, like, and not just singling out the Middle Eastern countries, but in this situation, the Middle Eastern countries, it wouldn't have had the direct impact. But there has been a global movement of domestic workers, Maria Teresa mentioned earlier. I think that itself did play a role in this situation. Pauraki, Bijaya Rai, who was prominently featured from Pauraki, who was interviewed in the radio piece and was around a lot. She was one of the people who founded Pauraki, who herself was a returned migrant worker and has been working, organizing migrant workers in Nepal, and having that network definitely helped push this issue at an international level. And there was a massive campaign around Save Dolma to raise money and to raise awareness about this issue. She mentioned that the NRN movement, the Non-Resident Nepali Association, took it up as one of their causes and were able to raise the funds to an extent that some of the funds raised in New York was not needed. So there was actually a lot of more money was raised than was needed, and because they were also able to negotiate it down. And so, but I guess, I mean, Dolma's case, this story also, what I think is, it is Dolma's story, but it's also so much more than Dolma's story. And we actually never see her. We never hear from her. And there's so many things that's leading to that situation of her having to migrate out, and her having to migrate, go to Kuwait without ever being registered in Nepal. So when it first happened, Nepal government did not have records of her leaving. There were rumors that, like, she didn't exist. It was just a rumor. So there were all sorts of things that, like, that delayed the process also. And I mean, there are a lot of things that were brought up in the movie itself. This is the economic realities of having to migrate out, what happens once they're there, and the exploitation. I mean, migrant workers who are going knowing that they're going to do hard work, that they will be working long hours. I mean, many of the people who are working as migrant workers in Gulf countries or in Southeast Asia are often from the poorer socioeconomic backgrounds in Nepal, and they're used to long hours of work. But what people are really, like, trying to raise voice against, I guess, is that humility. Like, I think that, like, the scene that captures that most vividly to me is that woman who describes it being sitting in a row and being picked from that as if it's cattle. Like, you can just point to them and, like, you know, being picked as, like, just being treated as an object, or it's not like that dehumanization that happens in the process. I think that's the bigger problem, and that leads to the mistreatment. It's just another point I wanted to make is also, while we hear a lot about what's happening in the Middle East, and things are difficult in the Middle East more than other places, but there are people who are also not unhappy either. I mean, this movie captured it, and Kesang Setan's, the other movies, In Search of Rial, also captured it. Not everyone's unhappy about the process. But the thing I want to say is that, like, you know, these things are also happening here. And many of the things that I see, and the movie is like stories that we hear almost on a day-to-day basis at our community center, like right here in Woodside, and things that are happening in Manhattan, things that are happening in New Jersey or Connecticut as well. There is a global movement, and it's the names change, the faces change, but that the exploitation and the humiliation, the mistreatment everywhere. And I think for the domestic workers in particular, like it's true in Kuwait, it's true in United States, is that because you work in isolation, you're in someone's home, like it's that much easier to get exploited, and like and also becomes harder to speak up. And another thing is like you just become treated like family, and so you don't want to betray that like, family relationship, and so often like you take more exploitation than you would otherwise. So.
Thank you very much for those comments. I think we'll open it up to questions. If you could identify yourself, and also there are no ignorant questions. If people want to ask about Nepal, we might be able to help answer any questions about the film itself. I've spoken to the filmmaker a little bit about the actual process of making the film. It's sort of interesting in and of itself. So please, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. If not, I'll just talk.
Or there are people here who have experience in yes. Nepal also, and I know that. I see at least a few faces there. So, you know, feel free to jump in as well.
Hello, my name is Marusia. I work for Media Global. I was wondering if the government in Nepal was doing efforts to address the situation, like recently, and what has he done?
The situation about Dolma herself?
About migrant workers in general.
Well, again, I don't follow these issues that closely. Nepal's economy right now is very dependent on migration out of Nepal. It's thought that at least 25% of the GDP comes from economic migration. And up to more than 10% of the population is probably outside of Nepal at any given time, maybe as many as 4 million in a country that is only 30 million. And Nepal's economy, you know, it's a very poor country. There's been a civil war. There's been conflict. The economy is not in the best shape. There's not a lot of investment coming in. And migration has been a source of, you know, currency, of cash. And so the government, I think it has this complicated relationship with migration. I think it's the only thing that's really coming in to the country, and it's kind of buoying the economy to an extent. But at the same time, it doesn't, you know, migration can be very problematic in what it can do to a national economy. It doesn't really produce jobs in the country. The money that comes back can create this kind of bubble, which I think is being experienced right now in Nepal. In property prices and everything else, because there's lots of construction happening because it's all being fueled by this money from migrants that are sending money home. But so I think that it's sort of this laissez-faire attitude, I think, that the government has right now. I think it's encouraging it because it knows it's very reliant. But at the same time, you know, I think it knows it has some responsibility to ensure that the migration that happens is taking place in a more responsible way. But I don't think that's happening to any great degree. But there are other people in this room who probably know much more about this than I do. I'm sure Luna has some thoughts as well.
I think one of the things that is moving forward is that the labor attaché that they mentioned earlier, now they are trying to set up labor attachés to look into, I believe it's like in any country with more than 5,000 migrant workers working in that. They are trying to set up labor attachés that will look into these issues, and the government is from what I see, government has been more reactive than proactive in these cases. Like, you know, many of the embassies are also de facto like safe haven for when migrant workers run away, and so they are having to process those things as well, and they're not the most well-staffed entities either. And so they are and there has also been so much changes in the government itself that the government itself has not been stable either in Nepal. So it has been difficult to have any major impact, but there has been, I think there is a growing movement in Nepal to hold the government accountable towards it.
I mean, it's estimated that more than 1,000 young people are leaving the country every day to go abroad, and you know, there's been a civil society response to that, and I think what it's turning into, you know, it's not exactly clear yet, but but definitely, like, there's a push to push for more responsible
and
practices.
I think there's also the government's trying to, like, institutionalize things. The government, there's only so much they can do. Like, for example, like, the Philippine government negotiated with many of the countries to have increased the minimum wage, and then the receiving countries just went to Bangladesh or Nepal. And so, like, the, in one way, like, you're raising up the minimum wage for your citizens, but then, you know, your citizens aren't also losing that job market. So there hasn't been that much coordination among the sending countries, and which I think would actually have a bigger impact in terms of collective bargaining. And also, I mean, another news I read recently is that the people going out through formal channels decreased, but people who are going through informal channels increased significantly. So although the government can, the government has only so much control over like what people are going out, because also, like, India and Nepal has open borders, so to go to India you don't need visa, you can just go in. And
there was some talk in the film of it being illegal to go to Kuwait for women.
Right.
That's true, you know, also I think in Lebanon and some other places, but it's impossible to actually regulate that, because again, as Luna said, the Nepalis leave, they go to Delhi, they go to India, and then they go from there to their final destinations. And there's no check being taking place at that point of departure, you know. So it's you know, it's totally untransparent and unregulated, and that's the real, I think, concern that, you know, my colleagues are hoping to address some of their work.
And it's not an easy thing either, because on one hand, like, you know, you want it regulated, but also you don't want to prevent people's right to move freely, you know, because the people do have right to move. And so.
Hi, my name is Nilvia Coyote. I'm about to start working in the Mexican consulate here in New York. So I think that is a great movie that shows, like, the difficulties of overseas workers. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about successful experience, if you know about those. For example, about the Philippines, because it's very interesting to see that the problem is between a Filipino worker and a person from Nepal. And since in the Philippines, they have these huge institutional arrangements to send people to countries. And do you know from this film, like, successful experience where workers have been able, like, through the arrangements between the countries, such as Kuwait and all these countries that receive workers, and other countries such as the Philippines, what would be successful experience for countries that send migrants to have their rights respected? Or if you, what would be those next steps that countries such as Nepal, or I mean, like, in the future, countries such as in the north of Africa or Mexico, to have the rights of the workers respected? Or do you think it will take, like, I don't know, what kind of next steps? I don't know if I'm explaining correctly.
The people probably who can talk more in detail, but I think in terms of what can be done, it has to be on both sides, like, you know, educating the people. But I mean, to an extent, like, when you see everyone going abroad and coming back with goods, and there's a much more, I think one of the things that has happened with the inflow of money is that there's a lot more conspicuous consumption. So it's not just the absolute poverty, but it's the difference, like, also that's increasing, that makes people want to go, and people are going to go anyway. So, like, I think educating the people about how they can protect themselves once they're I mean, want to like raise more awareness about what's happening, but I think that's, and people know in Nepal, like every day one or two body of a migrant worker comes back to Nepal. And people know about this. So it's not that people are completely unaware, but it's like, you know, so people feel like they do the cost-benefit analysis and, you know, the possibility of a better future for themselves and their children wins out, and so they go anyway. So I think the importance of, like letting people know about their rights and to make them aware about what they can do when they this happens. And then from the government side, also to just use the resources to properly staff the consulates or the embassies there. And I think like in a longer term, to be able to position such that so that they can negotiate with the receiving countries. It's like if the different government, like the sending country governments collaborate, and probably Maria Teresa, you can speak more about like this.
Thank you for the question. It's pretty loaded, of course. I think that our approach and our look is that migration has to be addressed in the entire spectrum of the process, from way early before migrants enter into contracts. A lot of the preparedness that programs like in the Philippines exist are geared to migrants who already have signed up to go abroad. So we have taken a few steps back and decide, and looking at what happens much earlier, before migrants in rural areas, for instance, and their families, not just themselves, but their families, are able to have at their disposal a lot more information about not only the risks, but understand what laws exist that may protect them, what resources to utilize in case that they experience problems in the whole migration process. So starting all the way from the very beginning, before a decision is made, so that at least migrants and their families are making these decisions more informed, is one of the beginning. But from there on, there are multiple stages in that migratory process that all of us who are concerned with this issue are trying to put in place better policies, better legal protections, and resources for migrants. In the process, we also have to learn and know that there are a lot of problems that migrants experience in transit. So it's not just at the recruitment early stages, in transit, and certainly when they arrive. We're hoping to also be spreading and encouraging more post-arrival preparedness and orientation programs, so that the programs, like in the Philippines again, are reinforced with information once the migrant arrives in the destination country. Countries, and also 6 months into it, the information that they receive is, you wouldn't believe, it's like a whole semester in a few hours that they're supposed to learn and understand and remember all of this. But really, it's also, as Luna mentioned, it's extremely important for governments, civil society, other actors to be looking at a regional approach so that there is not a competition among countries and a race to the bottom. By facilitating collaboration and information sharing to create some standards that cut across the region is what the Domestic Workers Convention is, one of those new tools that we all hope will, over time, will lead to that. But there are also a number of steps that countries can take in that lead up to ratification, for instance, of the convention. There was a question earlier about the impact, or actually, Jonathan, you mentioned the impact of the convention. What we talked about ratification, and that is indeed an important goal, this alone already serves as an instrument for countries to make reforms at the national level on a number of laws and practices that will benefit migrants. So I think that we have a very powerful instrument, and it has created such momentum that we believe that there are some openings here that we can work with. But anyway, it just, again, it's quite a bit of information. Luna also talked about working with embassies and consulates and building that capacity. Our approach, again, and meaning the Open Society Foundations, but along with all the advocates who are very active and much more of an expert in the subject, is to really bring to do a multi-sector approach to these issues. It's not just governments. It's not just civil society. We have a very important sector here we haven't talked about much, and that is the private sector, the recruitment agencies. In Nepal, one of the most interesting recent facts that became clear to us is this pre-recruitment process, it's dominated in Nepal by the private sector, by recruitment agencies. It's not, the government is not involved in it. It's not the NGOs. So we are now in the process of mapping and understanding what the parameters of all of these systems are so that we can then advocate for some reforms and changes, the entire process. So, Inna, for me.
Hi, my name is Margaret Williams, and I work at Crisis Group. Thank you so much for showing this film. It was amazing, so much information, and really brought a lot of factors together that shed light on this really important issue, and like a humanity-based issue. But my question, I'll just keep them brief. The role of the diaspora and the role of like PR and marketing. So in the film, it seemed like things changed when the Nepalese communities outside of Nepal were really mobilized. And that's when, like, the government figure all of a sudden cared. And not that they don't care, but it's just that's what seemed to me to be the case. So kind of wondering what the role is of the diaspora in all of this. I know it's a really big question, but maybe you can talk a little bit about your community center as well. And then also getting to what you just mentioned as far as tracking the process and the beginning and the end. And what I was wondering is, clearly language is a barrier, and language can be a huge hindrance to people knowing their rights and becoming advocates for themselves. I was wondering, on the beginning stages and also at the end stages, when they reach their destination countries through these agencies, if there are tools, or is one of the things that a way to try to better their situation is to try to give them information, like basic language tools that they can use, that they would either receive in Nepal or the beginning country and then the destination country. Thank you.
It's a multi-part question. So the role of the diaspora, I think diaspora did play a big role in this particular case. There was Saved All My Campaigns all around. There were people, Nepalese in Australia, I believe even in Africa, were raising money, Nepalese all around the United States, in Russia, NRN movement, Russia, it's actually very much more active in Europe, and it's more of a fledgling movement here in the United States. But anyway, so everyone got behind this case and raised money as well as awareness about the case, which was great. It did help change, put pressure on the Nepali government also to take it up. And I think the challenge is to move from these like high-profile individual cases to the more general day-to-day issues, because these are things that's happening every day in the Middle East, in U.S., in many parts of the, pretty much anywhere migrant workers are. And also not just migrant workers, like you know, in Nepal, domestic workers are not treated much better. How to move from one individual case to a more sustained movement for social justice is a bigger challenge, and that's something that we're trying to do at Adhikar. We started out with a much more local focus, so we started talking about workers here, workers' rights here in New York City, and it happened that most of the people who came to Adhikar were domestic workers, and so we ended up getting more involved in the domestic workers campaign. So we have English classes, we have workshops, trainings, we have Know Your Rights training, leadership training, and then also we have started doing nanny trainings so that like people are both like aware of their rights and also like taking it more, becoming more professional in the set, and so are able to negotiate better work conditions. And we are seeing changes in that, in individual workers and as a community as well. And the passes of the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights in New York State helped a lot. Although, I mean, in terms of implementation, again, like, you know, it is a challenge, but to know that there is a law, that the law recognizes you, that you're no longer the excluded, you're no longer excluded from law, this gave a lot of moral support as well. So, I mean, that's some of the things that's happening at our community center, but what we're also trying to do at the community level is to change perception about like what it means, like, because a lot of the challenge and a lot of the exploitation that our members face are from other South Asians, and now as there is a growing group of Nepali professionals in their late 20s, 30s, 40s who have children, that now they're becoming employers, and the pattern is being repeated. And they might be the same people who donated to Save Dolma in Kuwait, but do not necessarily reflect on what they're doing to their domestic workers here or in Nepal. And so I think we're trying to raise awareness about that and try to change that as well. And that is, I guess, a longer-term process. And in terms of providing resources, I know that I believe ILO is trying to launch a project in Lebanon in multiple languages, like the, like booklets, Know Your Right booklets, and these are some of the things, how you say these certain words in Arabic, like just basic how to get by, you know, for resources. And there are safe migration programs in a lot of sending countries that are doing it, but if we coordinate more, that would probably help save resources also.
I think there's a push some places to do more radio work too around some of that, because there's a lot of potential, I think, with that.
Actually, they're working on a radio for New York Bill of Rights also.
Hi, my name is Susan Sergel. I feel very tall. I don't know what. I work for Lebanese American University, and I actually have some. I worked with our Women's Institute, and they recently produced some brochures with the help of OSI's International Women's Program for in different languages to help migrants coming from other countries to know what their rights are when they get into Lebanon. And I actually have some samples to give to you. I also used to live in Kuwait, and I was there from 2004 to 2007. And what I find really interesting, I really appreciated seeing this film, I think that there's the rights and the education part of and the legislation to create some, you know, protections for migrant workers. But, you know, the scene that really got to me was the Kuwaiti woman shouting about, you know, this her she doesn't want this worker anymore. And that mentality of treating people like they're slave, literally like they're slaves, is disturbing. And, you know, I think, I mean, even if women know what their rights are, like how to affect the, you know, the on the community level of how to affect that kind of awareness and to begin to change people's ideas about what workers are as opposed to, you know, beasts of burden in their homes. And, I mean, that is very, very typical in Kuwait. It's also common in Lebanon, but it's in Kuwait there's something even more about it. And I think there just really aren't that many organizations working on the, you know, on the community level to for that kind of awareness to even partner with. So, you know, it's just something that I don't know how much is being done. I don't know how to do that exactly, but it's certainly a challenge.
Thank you for that comment. We have indeed picked as an area to develop, so we are welcoming and initiating a process of deliberations and consultations over the next year, because I am also convinced that another element that has to be addressed is public attitudes, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what you're referring to. And, in, you know, we have a lot of experience in trying to address public attitudes towards minorities and migrants and in many parts of the world, but within the Gulf countries and the Arab world, it is a very steep hill. But you know, we've given ourselves that challenge indeed to figure out how we begin to influence the way workers are viewed as human beings, because they really are not, as you know, treated or even viewed as such, as human beings. But also, Jonathan just kind of briefly mentioned, we have been looking at the use of media as a way to reach migrants. Hopefully, we also will look at, as we in this year of exploration and strategizing on how to influence and change, shape public opinion in this particular migration corridor, Asia to the Middle East, the use of media, popular culture, soap operas, for instance, that households in the Middle East watch. We have been successful in other contexts in using that as a way of interjecting some views and opinions, and we might try things like that. Again, music, popular culture, it's extremely effective and influential, much more than your traditional lecture. But anyway, it's the type of things that we don't know if in this context this will be appropriate, but it's the type of things we're looking for, and we're looking for partners and ideas. So again, it's a whole line of work we're developing.
It's very exciting. And one thing, and it's quite exciting. The World Cup will be hosted by Qatar in 2022, I think. It's a long way away, but 2022. But I mean, it's a huge opportunity because they are building an enormous number of stadiums. They're bringing in 1 million workers to do this, and Nepal is one of their main source countries. And you know, the World Cup is such a huge global event. It presents a tremendous opportunity to influence opinions in the region, in Qatar itself, in the region, and sort of internationally about the role of migrant labor. So there are things that I think that are happening. I think you'll see that there'll be a big push to do more of that kind of work around some of these things.
I was going to, at last time we were here, Singapore, that they were doing children's essay competition to talk about their experience with their domestic worker. And so mm-hmm. I guess started getting them to talk about the positive at a young age and getting them to reflect on it early on. So, I mean, it'd be a longer-term project. But I think one of the things that they done successfully, at least at the initial stages. And at the, in New York, also, we had a very good experience working with employers, because Jews for Racial and Economic Justice formed an employers group where they would have meetings in their living rooms and talk about these issues among employers and saying, like, this is what I am doing, these are the best practices. And then they became very strong advocates for the Bill of Rights campaign here, and now they formed, there's a national organization called Hand in Hand, that's of organization of employers who are supporting the domestic workers movement now. Helped that it came from peers, and I think that it's much more effective than an advocate, an activist lecturing.
Hello, this is Sangay Dolma Sherpa. I'm from Nepal. I was raised and born in Nepal, and I'm here doing my undergrad in Hunter College. I have a question. There was one scene where the Dolma's husband said that, I told her not to go. I said that once I get well, I'll go and earn it. That kind of was the issue of the gender equality, I think. And Dolma's case, probably, I don't know if the number of the immigrant, female immigrant workers going to Kuwait and working there decreased after the Dolma's case or increased after that, and whether it had in Nepal, what I think the what probably made impact was women should just refrain in the four walls, within the home of four walls, and usually there are still people, there are only the male workers who usually go out abroad to earn and, you know, make the livelihood of the going for their families. And this Dolma's case probably has, you know, restricted women from going out abroad. That's, I think that's what I felt from the conversation between those Nepali, Dolma's husband and other people, guys talking in the group.
I think you raise a very important point about the role of gender, the role gender plays within Nepali context before migration, like how women are viewed and how women are also, they're often the less educated also, and so when they go, they are more vulnerable. So it is true that oftentimes women go, and what's seen as women's work is domestic work, or like it's not even seen as work, it's just what you do. And so what you are only trained to do the women's work, and so you go into to work in other people's homes, and the circumstances are such that you are more exploited. So it is true that women end up becoming more exploited, but not necessarily just because they're women, but there are many other factors that play into it. Right? I mean, this is true for a lot of our Nepali sisters here also. They are working as domestic workers in other people's home in New York also, and are more exploited, and are often, they don't have anyone to talk to about that, and so more likely to just, for the exploitation to continue longer as well. But I think in terms, I don't know the exact numbers in terms of like the number of Nepali women who went out, but Nepali government actually stopped women from going to Kuwait through official channels after Kani Sherpa's case, which they mention briefly in end of 98, I believe. Kani Sherpa was also a domestic worker in Kuwait, and she was physically abused by her employers, and she was taken to the hospital, and her only option was to go back to them or go to jail. So she has given two options, like to go to jail or go back to the people who actually beat her to the point that they had to go, she had to be hospitalized, and so she chose the third option, and she killed herself. And so as a result, the Nepal government said, all right, this is not safe for Nepali women to go to Kuwait, so we're not sending you anymore. But people were going anyway, right? So they were going, and Dolma Sherpa also went through India, and at that time they were saying that 25,000 Nepali women were there. So so I think, like, instead of, like, creating these restrictions, I think we need to think about it in a more holistic way. Like, how can we make sure that our workers who are abroad don't get exploited? And workers within the country are also not exploited as well. And so, like, this is, it's a more holistic conversation than the way it's happening.
And I wanted to thank OSI for filming and screening this movie, and also Luna Didi for, you know, have the organization Adhikar, as everyone's mentioning. It's really doing something great. And it's the organization built by women. I think the foundation was, yeah, it was led by women. So thank you so much.
And actually, just since you mentioned that, like, it was on purpose that it is a women-led organization. We are not just a women's rights organization. We are a human rights social justice organization. But we have kept the leadership all women in response to the lack of meaningful leadership roles for Nepali women in our community. And we have faced a tremendous backlash about this, but we are persevering and, like, you know, trying to get established as a legitimate human rights organization. And I mean, it's like a bittersweet, like, reality is that we are the only staffed Nepali human rights organization in the entire country. So although our focus is New York, like, we get calls from all over the country about anything and everything, from missing people to domestic violence to how to enroll your child in school. It's so it is that we are dealing with a lot of things, and many of the things is because mostly women were not educated in Nepal and are in, like, need a lot more support here. Mm-hmm. So.
And the organization, I will spell it now. It's Adhikar, and it's Adhikaar. And their website is that at .org. And
I have some brochures.
You have some brochures. So grab a brochure from Luna and check them out and support them, because they're doing really important work. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Luna, for contributing so much to the conversation and to the Migration Initiative for hosting this. And we'll do it again soon, so come back. And thank you very much.
Thank you for hosting, and thank you for coming. It is an important conversation.